So I'm sure many of you have heard the expression, snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. It's a military expression, it's used in a lot of different contexts, but what I learned recently is there's another expression. Many of you will have no idea what Reddit is, that's okay, you don't want to go there. It's a dark corner of the internet where people kind of share stories and everything. But one of the popular feeds there is actually the opposite. It's snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. So as you can imagine, this one is a little bit more ironic. I think the German term that they use is Schadenfreude, which is this idea of like everything is going well and it's that train wreck that you can't look away from. Of kind of having all the pieces there and then watching it collapse. And for me, one of the examples that I think stands out the most is in 2003. I happen to be a Cubs fan. I know baseball season is getting rolling right now. But I remember the excitement. We knew there was that curse, and I don't believe in those curses, but the Cubs had been bad for a long time. And this year, they were great. And as we were watching the playoffs, the Cubs were doing so well. And we were only a few outs away from going to the World Series when a foul ball was hit into the stands. And Moises Alou goes to catch it. And this lifelong Cubs fan is sitting there and he doesn't exactly know what to do, but a foul ball in what could be the game before the World Series is there, and he snatches it away from Moises Alou to be that out that would have been one closer to the Cubs going to the World Series. Now, if you remember historically what happened after that moment, the Cubs kind of just lost it. There were errors, there was bad pitching, and not only did they go on to lose that game, they went on to lose the next game and the series, and their playoff hopes were over, and the hopes of another World Series were over. I know since then, the Cubs did make it to a World Series, and graciously, Steve Bartman there, who kind of made the blunder, and became the scapegoat, was invited to be part of those things, which I think was good because Chicago didn't like him very much for kind of a while. he had to have a private security detail because there were so many death threats made against this poor young man. Oh, yeah. And but again, he was the scapegoat. And that's an interesting term. If you haven't heard it before, scapegoat actually is a biblical term. It was part of the Jewish practice that all of their sins would be put onto a goat, and that goat would then be released from the camp to run away with all of the guilt and all of the sin. It was the scapegoat. But again, it wasn't his fault necessarily. And there's even argument to whether Moises Alou would have even been able to make the catch. Because you see there, he's got quite a few inches fully extended that he would need to get to make it happen. But our lives and history is filled with these moments where everything seems to be going well. And then at the last minute, it all collapses. It all falls apart. Sometimes we win a great victory, but in winning the victory, we lose the war. We miss out on what we're supposed to do. So Steve Bartman became the scapegoat, and but in reality, the Cubs failed to finish well. And in Judges chapter 8, we see that Gideon becomes a cautionary tale as he fails to finish well and tarnishes his legacy. As I was preparing this series on the Judges, initially I only planned to have a two-part Gideon series. I didn't plan to preach three messages on Gideon, but as I read what happened to Gideon after his victory, and I read about the legacy he left in his son, I thought it was very important for us to take some time and meditate on what it means for us as Christians, as followers of God, to finish well. Because Gideon doesn't. Gideon, in a way much larger than anything the Chicago Cubs ever did, any sports team ever accomplished, he snatches defeat for his people from the jaws of victory. He follows up this great victorious battle, this moment that God used him, and did it in such a way that only God could receive the glory, to in the end take the glory for himself and lead Israel right back to where they started, maybe worse. It's easy for us to pick on Gideon because we see his story laid out in the Scriptures. We see the good, and the Scriptures are so amazing. One of the things that I'll talk to when somebody says, "Jeff, do you really believe the Scriptures are accurate?" One of the pieces, and there's so many that I look at, is that the Scriptures are brutally honest. I don't know, there's an expression out there in history and history books that history is written by the winners, and the winners tend to kind of censor their history and tell their story in the best way possible. But the writers of Scriptures, those who captured the Bible and have preserved it, they don't just tell the good stories. In fact, almost all of our heroes are also at points villains. That's why in the book of Judges, as we're studying it, we're saying the overarching theme is no perfect people allowed. All of the leaders we see here, and even throughout the New Testament, outside of Jesus, even our heroes of the faith like Paul, he still was a murderous man when his name was Saul, killing and persecuting Christians. Peter denies Christ three times. They actually put in there the moments that Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." If I'm writing it down personally, probably leaving that part out. But we get this honest look. What I don't want us to do is to heap on Gideon and say, "Oh, well, Gideon was just, he was just not a good leader. He was just a flawed man." And I hope that we can move past what he did and apply it to our own life and realize that for each of us, as we worship and serve God, there is a temptation for us to finish poorly too. The Me Too movement has rocked our world, and you see all of these folks in Hollywood, and rightly so, having to take a step back because of things and serious mistakes that they've made and were not held accountable for. But that led to something called the Church Too movement. And while it was easy for me to point at Hollywood and say, yeah, they're a bunch of sinners, when it came to the church, and I saw pastor after pastor that I respected all of a sudden having a fall from grace and having to step down because they had affairs and they had other impropriety and things that they had done. Pastors that I respected, pastors that I studied, I'd read their books. At that point, I realized that it's not about pointing fingers. It's about saying, "God, thank you for the grace that I've received, because outside of that grace, any of us could make the same mistakes." So we're going to take a deeper look at Gideon this morning, and we're going to see some of the pitfalls that he did in hopes that we can avoid them and can choose to have intentional legacy so that God can make a difference through us that outlives our lifetime. So we're looking at Judges chapter 8, verses 22 through 35, if you want to follow along in your own Bible, but I'll have it up on the screen if you can read it. So this is after the battle. "The Israelites said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, your son and your grandson, because you have saved us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon told them, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And this sounds great until you hear about what happens next. And he said, I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder. It was the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. And they answered, we'll be glad to give them. So they spread out a garment, and each of them threw a ring from his plunder onto it. The weight of the gold rings he asked for came to 1,700 shekels, not counting the ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian or the chains that were on their camels' necks. Now, we see people roll around with gold chains on their necks to be cool. These kings had gold chains around their camels' necks, and that's how they knew that they were hot stuff. So they had all of this to melt down. And what did Gideon choose to do? Gideon made the gold into an ephod, which he placed in Ophrah, his town. All Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. Thus Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise its head again. During Gideon's lifetime, the land had peace 40 years. Jerubbaal, son of Joash, this is Gideon's other name, went back home to live. He had 70 sons of his own, for he had many wives. His concubine, who lived in Shechem, also bore him a son, who he named Abimelech. And Abimelech, just so you know it, it's translated son of the king. So it's an interesting name to pick, considering he said, oh, I will not be king, but my son's name will be, he's the son of the king. Gideon, son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abrazites. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to Baals, the idol for Baal worship. And they set up Baal Berith as their god and did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Doesn't just say here that they were rescued from the Midianites. It's in this period of prosperity, God had preserved them and rescued them from every enemy on every side. They also failed to show any loyalty to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in spite of all the good things he had done for them. So we need to look at where things went wrong, because for many of us, this and the next chapter are passages that we flip through quickly. When we study Gideon in Sunday school as kids, we don't go over this part. We leave it at the victory of the 300 men with their trumpets and their jars that they shatter. And that's where we stop telling the story. But that victory led to defeat. And it begins with the problem of the pedestal. The people ask Gideon to be king. He says no, but his actions say otherwise. You don't say, oh, I don't want to be king, and then name your son, son of the king. You don't say, oh, no, I don't want to be king, and then take up a whole harem of wives and concubines and have a kingly number of children. You don't say, I don't want to be king, and set up a testament to your greatness for everyone to come make pilgrimage and worship. He said he didn't want to be king, but he became de facto king when God's plan all along was that God was the king, that God was the leader, that God was doing something with Israel that no other nation had seen. We went over the tabernacle, and the whole purpose of this tent being made was that God was going to choose to come dwell in the camp. They weren't worshiping a distant God, a faraway God. They were worshiping the God who came to dwell among them, who came to lead them there. And yet Israel, over and over again, they said, "Oh, give us a king like all the other nations have." That was the rallying cry. You see that multiple times throughout the Judges, but then ending the period of the Judges, we see it in the story of Samuel as he is set to anoint Saul to be king. He warns them. He says, "This is what the king will do. You don't want this." And the people say, "No, the other nations have a king and they're prosperous. We're looking around us and we want to be like all of our neighbors." When God's plan was for them to be different, for them to be a city on a hill, for them to be a lighthouse to all those in darkness. The people ask Gideon to be king. He says no with his mouth, but his actions say otherwise. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, your son and your grandson." And this set a dangerous precedent, because if you go on to the next chapter, Abimelech, his son, who literally means, "I am the son of the king," he takes this very literally and he decides that he is going to be the next ruler, that he is going to take over for his father. But if you read the next chapter, not everybody's so into it. So where it was stumbles for Gideon, for Abimelech, it's deceit and it's treachery and it's murder. And the consequences are great. By making himself king, by making his bloodline the line of authority, we see father slip and son become something terrible. It's a very dark stain on the history of Israel. But all leaders that are successful will suffer from this same temptation, because we, as people, have a tendency to elevate those that we like, those that are successful. And if you don't believe this, just look at the sports world and celebrity. We take people because they can throw a ball well. And again, in the grand scheme of things, they can throw a ball well. And I'm a football fan. I like to root on Peyton Manning. But just recently, I was at a conference, and they had the person who organizes all of it had years ago, they held it in Nashville. They had hired Peyton Manning to come in, and you know, he's got this really nice public persona. But she said, "Oh, it was a nightmare." They hired him to take pictures with people, and he's like, "Nah, I'm not going to take pictures with any. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be around people." He was hired to speak for a certain amount of time. He said, "I'm going to give you 15 minutes." And he was very expensive. And they did every one of his strange requests. And he was mean to all of the staff. But we worship him because he can throw a ball well. We have a tendency to put up on a pedestal people that we see as successful. And I don't fully understand it. But we do this. I mean, the most popular articles that you read on anything are the celebrity ones. That's why my phone thinks it's breaking news that I have to know every time the Kardashians do something. And I could care less. But we have a tendency to put leaders up on a pedestal. And the higher we put that pedestal, the more temptation we place in the leader's path. And the bigger the fall off the pedestal will be. Because again, when God seeks leaders, no perfect people may apply, because none of us are perfect. None of us can live up to that expectation. And all of a sudden, that leader tries to be something that they're not. We try and thrust them ever more into the spotlight. And this, as a congregation, while the sin of the leader follows, and the leader's responsible for taking that place on the pedestal, we're responsible for putting him there. And we have to own that together. And we have to be careful, because the only person who has room to be on the pedestal is Jesus. He's the only one worthy of our praise. He's the only one worthy of our worship. He's the only one who won't let us down. And as the Proverbs say, hope deferred makes the heart sick. If we begin to thrust our leaders up on pedestals, not only will we be disappointed, but we'll see churches crumble. When I spent time at a larger church and there was infidelity and there was rumor and innuendo and the church split and the leaders left, I know people that were really trying to live their lives for Jesus, but because of the wound and the trauma of all that, they walked away from the church for so long. Said, I don't want anything to do with it. It has consequences. So we have the problem of the pedestal, but that leads further into the pursuit of glory. So if we take a leader and we prop them up on the pedestal, that is, it feels very good, and it becomes addictive. Gideon, as they are praising him and they're thrusting upon him glory, he begins to pursue it for himself. Gideon collects gold from the spoils to craft an ephod. And this ephod is an interesting thing. It's a spiritual thing. If you remember back from the sermons we did on the priesthood and the temple, the ephod was this plate that that was part of the whole religious garb and clothing, uniform that the priests would wear. So an ephod in and of itself isn't a sinful thing. And maybe even Gideon's intentions started out good. But number one, God had a lot of things to say about the spoils of war. And very often he would not allow them to make spiritual things for his use out of spoils of war without a lot of other kind of special things happening. It had to be God say, here's what I want you to do. And God put an exclamation point on it when he said, I want you to take what you plundered from Egypt and turn it into these things. It wasn't incidental. And Gideon here is like trying to recreate that, but with no command from God to do it. And if we're honest, how many of us are guilty of the same thing? Where God did something great in our lives 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and we're hungry for a fresh move of God, for a fresh touch of God. So we try and go through the motions of what God did once before and recreate it now without God's leading. And he creates this ephod, but this ephod becomes an idol. It becomes a snare, not only to the people, but to him. And everyone makes pilgrimage to his hometown to go to this ephod that's standing there, made of gold, made of a lot of gold. Not a little gold, a lot of gold. A lot more than the ephod that would have been in the tabernacle or temple. And they go, and the scripture makes it very clear, all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there. And it became a snare to Gideon and his family. As we look at this passage and even the end of his victory, we see some strange things happening here in chapter 8. It's kind of a long passage and we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to summarize it. But Gideon is pursuing the two kings or leaders of Midian with his 300 men. And it's going very well. Many, many men have died. He's confronted first by some of the generals of Manasseh, and they're a little sore about the fact that they weren't included. Why, Gideon, are you and your 300 men taking all the glory here when you had our army on the sideline and you didn't take it? And Gideon makes a joke about it, and it goes well. And the guys are like, well, yeah, we're pretty great, so we'll let you go and do your thing. And he goes on, and he goes to another small village town along the way, and he said, my men are hungry, and they're tired. You need to feed us. And they're like, well, didn't you just, take it from the spoils of war? Didn't you just defeat these generals? Like, we don't have a lot, so take it from them, not from us. And Gideon is super offended by this. And his response is, you have disrespected me. I'm going to go and finish this thing, but when I come back, I'm going to find out every leader who denied this, and I'm going to take these thorns from the desert, and I am going to just mar your body with them. And they go to the second town, and it's this place called Peniel, and there's a tower there, and they do the same thing. They said, there's so much food for you there. Just take that food. We're hungry. We don't have a lot. And he said, I'm going to find out, and I'm going to be back, and I'm going to punish you. And he does. In fact, he kills all of the leaders from that Peniel who don't give his men food. And there's this thing about leadership that I think gets a little scary. When leaders can't be questioned, and when leaders can't be made fun of, when they take themselves too seriously, it's probably, and again, I don't want to get political because I'm going to probably have something. I'll say it this way. There is not one politician in this world that I don't have something critical to say of, okay? Is that fair? Like, none of them are on my, this is a great list, okay? So I'm not a fan of any of them. But our current president, one of the things that trips me up about him a little bit is the fact that if anybody makes fun of him at all, he wilts and he becomes so angry. That's not godly leadership. We can't take ourselves too seriously. And what happens is the people begin to thrust the leader up on a pedestal, and then we as leaders like it. And when somebody says, how dare you disrespect me? A few weeks ago, Gideon was hiding from the Midianites in a cave up in the mountains, threshing grain in a wine press, terrified, hungry. And now he is hot stuff that if you question him, he's going to come back with thorns and he's going to just ravish you. And he does. He leaves the men he doesn't kill just bleeding and hurt. You see this slide happening. You must respect me. You must honor me. And now he builds this ephod, a spiritual thing, but instead of it being a part of worship to God in the tabernacle, it becomes a symbol and a place for people to worship Gideon. Again, God doesn't use the word prostituted themselves by worshiping it there lightly. This is no longer just a neutral spiritual item. It becomes a symbol of Gideon's accomplishment. And I don't want to make, I'm not here to pick on, I think there are great large churches. I don't want to have the war between little churches, big churches, all of that. But I have walked into big churches where there was like an 8-foot portrait of the pastor, that was the first thing you saw, and then the cross was somewhere around the corner. Maybe it was in their logo. And I can't help but draw a connection. We do these things. Oh, it's a testament to God's glory, but my face needs to be really big on it. And I have no problem honoring a former pastor that we love that passed away or moved on by naming a room in the church and saying it's the whatever memorial. I don't have a problem with that. But when all of it becomes a testament to the greatness of that leader, I think that we're in dangerous territory. And we do this in Big C Church and Christianity a lot. Where we elevate, and so we put them on a pedestal, and then they begin to take themselves too seriously. They pursue the glory. They name their sons things like, my son is the king, or no, my son is the son of the king, which is a weird thing. I mean, think about it. Then finally, we see unintentional legacy. After Gideon dies, the people forget both him and the Lord, and his son becomes a tyrant. Verse 33, no sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals, to these false and wicked gods. It was like it never happened. Everything went back to where it began. And it's easy to pass over this because this is the story of the book of Judges. A judge is raised up. He redeems the people because they heard, God heard their cry. And then after the death of the judge, things go back to like it never happened. The people go right back to where they were. But you have to look, Gideon's story, it feels different. There's more there than even some of the others. There's more promise. There's more opportunity. God is so very intentional to make sure he gets the glory for the victory, but yet it is still taken by Gideon. And what I want you to know today, what I want to leave you with today, is that all of you will leave a legacy, whether you intend to or not. It's not optional. We don't get to hit, pass. You remember Charles Barkley, the basketball player? He came out and people were kind of mad about his behavior. And remember what he said, the famous line? He said, I am not a role model. But you are if people follow you. It's not you don't get to choose whether or not you're a role model. And we don't get to choose whether or not we leave a legacy. We will leave an intentional legacy, one that is powered by God and filled with his spirit and born of his kingdom, or we will leave an unintentional legacy, one in which there will be consequences in our children and our grandchildren for our actions, for our weakness, for the times that we were afraid and didn't have faith. And here, Gideon leaves an unintentional one because, again, not just do the people go back, but his son, the one he named my dad is king, comes in and just brutalizes. He becomes very Machiavellian, if you understand that term. He is all about politics, and he kills his enemies, and he's deceitful, and he's rotten, and he has no love for God. And he leaves Israel, if you read the next chapter, worse off than when Gideon found him. So we all leave a legacy. Gideon's legacy stinks. It's not what he wanted. This isn't the legacy that the man leading the 300 trumpet players had in mind, but it's the legacy he left. My question to leave you today as we go into communion is, what legacy will you leave? What legacy will you leave? And today that could be exciting. You might have a book to write about what God's doing, and that's fantastic. But if right now you're feeling a little bit anxious or you're feeling a little bit sorrowful and saying, what legacy do I have to leave? That, or you're looking at it and saying, maybe my legacy feels more like Gideon's legacy. I didn't intend to, but I'm not proud of it. I want you to know it's not too late. If there is still breath in your lungs, if you are asking the question, if you are wrestling with it, it is not too late to leave an intentional legacy that glorifies God. Not us. It's not about building a testament to us. And look at all that I have done. It's about building a legacy that glorifies God. And I want you to hold that thought as we walk into communion together.